is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to hold a simultaneous public hearing on all of these tax credits. So I'm going to, if you bear with me, open up a public hearing on House Bill 2113, 2116, 2119, 2122, Senate Bills 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 49, and 212. We're on public hearing on all of those bills because we have presenters who are going to speak on multiple bills at the same time. Before we get to that, I'm going to ask Chris to kind of go through the concepts we're looking at and kind of put some of this into perspective. Chris.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Despite the 12 bills, at a higher level, there are only three concepts before you. You have child care tax credits, you have disability-related tax credits, and then you have two other bills that I've categorized as health care tax credits. They are a long-term care insurance premium tax credit and for costs in lieu of nursing home care. So those three categories. For the child care credits, you have four bills. For the disability-related credits, you have six bills, and then two bills for the other two. I think Rep. Kenny Geyer and Rep. Hayden are here to talk about. Rep. Hayden has an amendment he specifically wants to talk about to one of the Senate bills. Rep. Kenny Geyer is going to talk about the process that went on in her policy committee. Most of these bills are the standard sunset extension bills that were introduced at the beginning of the session. The one exception to that is Senate Bill 212. So at a high level, there are three concepts. You have a variety of materials in OLIS that I believe we'll get to one piece at a time. So at a very high level, that's kind of the Cliff Notes version.
Right. Okay. Well, let's bring our legislators up first who are here. Reps Kenny Geyer, Hayden, and Senator Dembrough is here too. Representative Kenny Geyer, I know you've done a lot of work on these, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, state representative for House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland.
I'm Michael Dembrough, senator from District 23, that's Northeast, Southeast Portland, and I also chair the Workforce Committee.
Senator Hayden, state representative from House District 7. I serve on the Human Services and Housing Committee.
I know we have a lot of tax credits to get through this morning. I just want to say something about the process and how the Senate and the House side have tried to approach this before coming to you. And then I think Senator Dembrough will say a few words about it and then probably be released. Representative Newt Bueller worked with me in the Human Services and Housing as kind of my partner in the tax credit, and so he was hoping to be here this morning also just to kind of endorse the process, say a few words. But the two of them were really going to address process more than content, and then Representative Hayden has a particular amendment that he's going to introduce for one of the tax credits. I just wanted to start, though. First of all, I want to thank Chris Alanak and the whole team for the incredible job that you did on the expiring tax credits, the whole report. A lot of digging into history and trying to find what the original reasons for those tax credits were, to the extent they could find that. Research, looking at policies and tying that to research. And so we took that report very, very seriously. We had a work group that Michael Dembrough came to several times, Newt Bueller and his staff, and a number of different stakeholders in the community to really pour into these tax credits. Most of the emphasis was on the child care tax credits, but some also on elderly and people with disabilities. And so we had a number of people from the Human Services Coalition, HISCO, from ARP, from Oregon Business Council, Oregon Business Association, John DePonia, people like that, that were all involved in this process. Do you have in front of you, I know, Chris, you were going to try to put some of these papers in front of people. There's just kind of a very high level, won't be purple for you, report that's an Excel sheet that talks about tax credit renewals and new proposals.
In OLIS, it is the tax credit summary table.
So just to say very briefly, I'm not even going to say what we did. I'm going to let you say a few words about the process.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Alyssa. Co-chairs, let me just say I don't really have a lot to say about this. This has been a great process. Representative Kenny Geyers, as you probably know, and I share the southern half of Senate District 23, and we talk a lot. And it just so happened that the Work and Families Tax Credit renewal question came to the Workforce Committee and it on the Senate side, and it came to the Human Services Committee, which Representative Kenny Geyer chairs on the House side. And so we started talking about it. You know, it's one of the benefits of the carpool system, you know, is that you have a lot of time to talk about things and compare notes. I should say the other half of my district is the good representative from District 45, Representative Smith Warner. And so we talked a lot about this, and it really made sense. The whole notion of the Joint Committee on Tax Credits is, you know, to come up with a single package, a single decision point. But it made sense for us to, in terms of the policy behind these tax credits, to have this kind of conversation between the two chambers. And it became clear that, Alyssa, that Representative Kenny Geyer was really onto something in terms of some changes that she was looking at with respect to the Work and Families Tax Credit and some savings that could be made there without harming the integrity of what those credits are intended to do. And so, it made sense to be part of this work group, and then our committee actually did not forward a proposal to you on the on that tax credit because it made sense to just work on this one. So that's all I have to say, I commend the process to you.
Well, and I was also going to say that Senator Dembro was on the Human Services and Early Childhood Senate Committee, which looked at the elderly and disability tax credits, and so you might want to say something about that, just that you forwarded them.
Yes, so we just forwarded those credits without a lot of conversation, again, knowing that the heavy lifting was happening on the House side.
Representative Kenny Geyer, you did a lot of work on two of the biggest tax credits here, the Working Family Child Care Credit and the Child and Dependent Care Credit. I'm wondering if you could, we have some new people who haven't been on the tax credit before, explain how these have worked over the years, and just sort of set the stage for those.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I think I'll take my leave now.
Thank you, Senator.
This is in capable hands.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all.
There is so much to say about that. What I was thinking is that we might want to have Representative Hayden address the one amendment just so that he, and I think he may stay for some of the conversation, but that will allow him to leave when he wants because there's a lot to say about the child care, and his is on the one particular one, disability. So if that's all right for him to at least bring that up.
All right, if you prefer to do it that way.
Well, I don't want him to have to stay through a really long conversation.
Thank you. Again, I'm Senator Hayden, and I just want to speak to one very small bill, House. It's Senate Bill 42. This bill is an extension of an existing tax credit that I believe was enacted in 1976, and it would extend that tax credit to 2022. It was discussed in our Human Service and Housing. It's now the Senate mirrored bill is now before you, and one of the discussions was the administrative cost of doing these tax credits when they're so small. Does the cost benefit pan out? And the other really important discussion I thought that we had during this process is to try and start to attach a purpose statement to each of these tax credits. So in the future, when they're reviewed, you can not only have the intent of the legislature, why they're enacting it, but hopefully going forward start to have studies on the efficacy of whether that worked or not. So very supportive of the process. Chair Kenny Geyer did a huge amount of work with her committee to wade through this. On this particular Senate Bill 42, After listening to the pros and cons of it, my amendment, which is now on OLIS as of this morning, simply takes the from the origination of it, I hope to get a purpose statement on this bill, and it indexes the tax credit. In 1976, I believe there was a $50 tax credit for disabled people that had, and this is additional above the regular disabled, which is, I believe, $141, of an additional $50 if they had lost two limbs, or one limb and one leg, or two legs. The importance to me for this bill is, although it applies to our general population, I believe it applies specifically to our military people that have been in an incident, particularly when they're defending our country. And even though it's a small amount of money, I think it's something that gives honor to them for doing that, and it does help the entire disabled population. The amendment simply takes back from the time that it was originated and says, we're going to amend this, give a cost of living adjustment to it. Doesn't change the original intent, keeps it intact. It would extend it to 2022, and so the rough cost of living adjustment that was determined with legislative council would be about $250 today, and then it would continue, if there was a cost of living increase, to continue during the time of the extension. That's all I have.
Okay, any questions on the loss of limb tax credit? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work on this.
Okay. Back for a while.
Okay,
Representative, give us the overview.
Back to child care.
on these two, child care tax credit and working family child care, how they intermingle, and the importance of continuing them.
I am happy to do that, and I'm wondering if you would indulge me and allow Chris Alanek to come up and sit by my side in case there's things that I can't.
No, I want.
Okay, if that's the case, I hope that
He's okay.
I hope that you will feel free to jump in from up there. Feeling lonely down here. I'm used to having him nearby.
I'll sit by you.
I'm losing everyone fast. I'm a little worried.
I can't
about
add
that.
Anything.
Representative, we believe in lifeboats in the Senate, so it's okay.
Okay.
We'll save you.
You need them over there. Okay. So the really big overview, and I don't want to get too into the weeds unless you invite me to get into the weeds, and unless Chris helps me in the weeds, is that both of the working family child care tax credit and the child independent care credit, which is the CDC, are both set up to allow families to be able to offset costs while they're gainfully employed. But what turned out was in the working family child care tax credit, which is eligible for child care for kids up to 12 years old or under 13 years old, plus children who are disabled up to 18 years old, and the CDC has the same for that part, for the child care population, same stipulation, same eligibility, that it would offset a certain percentage of expenses. And it turns out that both of them are so similar that out of the approximately 25,000 people that were claiming the working family child care credit, 23,500 were also claiming the CDC. So while we originally, I think many years ago, set up the working family child care tax credit to try to really enhance what we do for families, it ended up, instead of complementing it in some way, it really ended up overlapping. And as we went forward and really tried to figure out who are the 1,600 people in the last year that didn't claim the CDC, did have the working family, because we wanted to make sure that if we did something that was considered very radical in the beginning, which was close the working family child care, that's like a stake in the ground, you know, a sacred cow. It was like very radical to people to close that off. Who might you be losing in that process inadvertently? And so there is if down at the bottom of kind of my Excel overall sheet, it talks about who the people are that were not claiming the CDC, and some of them had income that was too high. Some of them got pre-tax benefits under the working family, but not under the CDC. That's actually a form of double dipping. It means that you're getting tax credits on something that when you have a plan by your employer to have child care. Normally, you're not going to hear from me something complaining about double dipping for low-income people. I think they need all the support they can. But in this case, it's really not because of need. It's by luck of who your employer is. So that didn't really seem fair. Though it's for people who are unable to use it because their tax liability was too low, which we're going to fix in the CDC. And some of it was unexplained. But what's also interesting is that it wasn't the same categories of people year after year. So there wasn't a systematic leaving people out. So that's what we really started with, is looking at, if we combine them, is there anyone that we're leaving out? And the other reason that we looked at combining them were two reasons. One kind of dropped by the wayside along the way. Originally, we were thinking, can we save some of the Department of Revenue costs? Right now, there are four people that are overseeing the working family, and there was no one overseeing the CDC because it's pegged to the federal, so the IRS is in charge of doing that. So we thought, if we can reduce, streamline it, drop the working family, fold it into the CDC, which is pegged to the federal, and reduce the cost to the Department of Revenue, that would be a great savings that could be used either for tax credits or to get the word out about tax credits. It turns out that we're not sure there's going to be a lot of savings at all. We'll have to see over time. There may be savings for the people who are claiming this who meet the same criteria as the original CDC, which is... Am I going too into details?
Yeah, you're getting ahead of us.
Okay.
Because you're so good at this, we're trying to keep up. So what you would do then is combine these two tax credits into one.
Right.
And that's what's in House Bill 2116.
Exactly.
So can you, and my understanding is this is kind of a revenue neutral proposition. Can you give us the hypothetical family where this would apply to and why this makes sense?
So hopefully you have in front of you these kind of charts?
In OLIS, there are two charts. There's a household size 3 and a household size 2.
If you open the household size 3.
That's the WFCDC tax credit H-hold 3.
And only you would have known what that meant.
We have them in paper on the desk.
We got hard copies. You have paper.
Oh,
yeah.
Paper copies would be great. So household 3. So here are all the things that we did to it before you dig into the numbers. We sunsetted the working family child care tax credit. We expanded the CDC. We folded it into the CDC. We allowed it to be more, and I also think I have a narrative, and I don't know what that's called in front of OLIS, a narrative explanation of all the things we did. We changed the income eligibility from the federal taxable income that used to be in the CDC that didn't line up with anything else. The working family used an AGI. The CDC didn't. So we did it to align it with the federal poverty line based on the AGI, because that allows us to try to align where are we going to bump this up when people fall off of TANF or when they fall off of Medicaid, when they hit those big cliffs. How can we make sure that we use this? The other thing about streamlining, although we're not sure it'll save any DOR costs or much, is that it, finally, by collapsing them, you can really see what we're doing in terms of when we give people the federal CDC and now the Oregon Working Family CDC, we're going to change the name, how does that line up? So you can see on this paper, we tried to really show you, and hopefully they're still in different colors on OLIS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on OLIS they're in color, and they're our color cop-out.
Okay, so you can see what the proposal is compared to what we've done in the past. So streamlining it does allow you to collapse them all into one, and we can see for families that are claiming this, you know, how are we really reaching them? We also shifted a higher credit to kids that are in infant and toddler care, so under 2 years old, because the ratio that the Office of Child Care in the state requires of that age is greater, and the cost for child care is greater. And so we basically took the information that Bobby Weber out of OSU, Office of Family Child Care, took to look at what are the real costs. And the real cost for infant care at the 75th percentile is somewhere around $1,100 at least per month. And so we tried to say, well, what should the expenses, you know, how should we cover the expenses? So that's another thing that we did along with policy, is show greater support for people in at the younger that they are and raise the caps.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Edwards.
So I'm trying to catch up. So the percentages on the sheet.
Yep.
Those are percent. I mean, I see 10. Like, I'm just going across the top row.
Yep.
On the right hand side of the spreadsheet, where it's proposed law, working family child and dependent care tax credit merged together. What do these percentages represent? Those are percentages
of expenses.
Of expenses,
exactly. Okay. And the old CDC was also of expenses. It was not tied to the federal in terms of being a percent of the federal credit. It was like the federal credit, the state credit was also a percentage of expenses.
And then the assumption is that assumes $3,000.
It used to be $3,000. We're raising it to $12,000 for one dependent. So the old CDC had caps of $3,000 for one dependent, $6,000 for two or more.
Okay.
The working family had no limit at all. Hmm. And so we tried to say, what is the cost of, you know, of child care? And we capped it at $12,000, even though 75th percentile is greater for infants. But we were trying to get something somewhat manageable. And then...
Hold on a second, Representative Chris.
So if I could add just to some of the tax parlance that at least veteran members will hopefully be familiar with. A couple things are the committees have dealt with the stacking of tax credits. And so this analysis takes three tax credits, a federal tax credit, and two Oregon tax credits, and looks at what is the bottom line impact for taxpayers when they look at all those credits. Because presumably, it's the same expense. Families are incurring $1,000 a month or $3,000 a year is the assumption here for child care. And on those expenses, they get a federal credit, which is a credit against their federal taxes, and then potentially two Oregon tax credits. So the way the table is structured here, the first two columns are federal poverty level, and the second two columns are AGI. And to fit these two together, because of happenstance, the two Oregon credits were structured differently. And going back and looking at them, you can tell that the legislature didn't deal with them at the same time. One of those credits was phased out according to federal taxable income, which is by itself is unusual for Oregon to phase something out regardless of the tax policy on a federal measure of income, federal taxable income. Normally, it would just be AGI. AGI is what people think of. If you ask somebody on the street, what's your income, the number that they will closest get to is the AGI. And so the Oregon CDC was phased out. Well, the federal CDC was phased out by AGI. The Oregon CDC was phased out by federal taxable income. And the Oregon Working Family Child Care Credit, was phased out by federal poverty level. So over time,
they probably voted for those.
We managed to make it as complicated as possible. So
we're Oregonians.
So the chart here is to take these three different policies, put them in one chart, so that to the extent possible, make it digestible for you as policymakers right now to look at them and compare what do you want to do. So the columns here, there's a federal CDC percentage, an Oregon CDC percentage, and a WFC percentage. Those are the three credits. These rates are, to borrow a term, effective tax credit rates. They are not the statutory tax credit rates. And the difference there is whether a tax credit is refundable or non-refundable. If it is non-refundable, then for taxpayers, they may be allowed a 30% tax credit, but if they don't have sufficient liability, they're not using it. So that's why, for example, on the federal CDC, it starts at 1% and 6% and 13%. And on the Oregon CDC, well, it, you know, for zero, it's for the bottom lowest income people, it's 0%, but then it goes 3%, 8%, 13%. And that's as these taxpayers have enough income and enough tax liability to use the credit.
Are these refundable now? Or any of these?
No. Oh, the working family is refundable, but it starts at $8,700. So people below $8,700 are getting no help whatsoever in child care. And here we are trying to get people back to work.
And under this bill, would they be?
Would be
refundable?
I think one thing that might be helpful before digging, these numbers are really helpful, and I'd love to go through some of them. But on the second page, shows what we're trying to do graphically.
On the back side.
On the back side of yours.
And or
the
or page down. If it's in the computer.
Page down. Okay. So what we try to do is replicate something like the EITC umbrella. So the more people work, the more they're incentivized because the more credit that they're getting. And then they kind of plateau out for a while, and then they tail off. So that's you can't see it on that one, I guess. Can you scroll down and just for a quick
we should be able to
a quick visual, and then we can go back to the numbers because I want to explain. We really pored over these numbers in our committee and in the work groups that maybe it doesn't go down that far. But you can see it on yours, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if you go back to the numbers, I wanted to point out several things on the numbers that were really problematic for us on the current. So if you look on the left side, which is the current working family and child dependent. Mm-hmm. And, oh, yeah. So that gives the red line is where we want it, what the proposal is. And the blue is what the current two Oregon tax credits and federal are right now. And you can see that they don't help people at the lower end at all, the combination of the two. And we wanted to really, you know, our policy directive was we really wanted to help lower income people get into the, you know, we hear about TANF and how hard it is for people in TANF to start getting jobs. We wanted to help that end of it. So if you go back to the numbers and you look at the federal CDC, the federal one has been 0, 0, 0, 0, and then 1% once they're at 100% to 110% of poverty. We know that the absolute largest cliff out there is when people fall off of Medicaid, which is now 133%. So we wanted to make sure that people, you know, in that category, after they fall off of TANF, which is at 37%, after they fall off of Medicaid at 133%, that they really start getting more help. And so that piece of it, the first few categories between the bolded area is where we wanted to pump it up. So that's where the top is. But we also wanted to make sure that people at the bottom end got something as they were starting to get back to work. And if you see the category, it goes up pretty rapidly, and between 40 and 50%, right when they've fallen off of TANF, it's 50%. I mean, I think there's some debate about it could be even higher, but we didn't want the number to be blown out of the water. The other thing is you'll see the 0 to 2-year-olds, if you look at those numbers, and then you look at 3 to 5-year-olds, they drop by 2%, basically, until you get down to the very bottom where they're tailing off. But for most of it, they drop by 2%, and then by another 3% when they get to elementary school, because the costs when you're in elementary school tend to be a lot lower, just because the ratio for after school ratio can be a lot higher. And then for 18 and older, this is the part of the CDC that was not covered by the working family. They actually get a relatively bigger bump up because they didn't have the working family tax credit at all. That was not intended for any people who are dependent care over age 18. And so this was the one that went up the most. We did have debate about whether, you know, why not make it at the same rate as the elementary school? Why not even bump it up further? But I think we were worried in making some of these changes that it could blow the cost out of the water. As it is, the estimated cost per biennium for this package is $3.8 million more by making these changes.
Question, Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I always love tax credits, especially when the co-chairs of Ways and Means get involved. I guess my first question is, because there's a whole stack here, and you're the chair, can you just summarize? I mean, was there pretty unanimous support across your committee on that side?
There was a lot of support for this. There were questions originally about refundability, but when we talked about, you know, really the reality is if you have a family and they have a choice, they're getting TANF payments or SNAP or anything else, and they have a choice to go back to work or not, and they go back to work but have huge child care costs, particularly if they have two kids. If you start thinking about two kids, transportation costs, it doesn't pan out for them to do it. And if they aren't getting any kind of tax relief, because they don't, their tax liability is too low, it's not an incentive. It's not serving the purpose that it was meant to serve. And so that was strongly, that ended up being supported by our entire committee. The biggest question on this one, I'd say, is how far do you put the tail out there? We tried to go somewhere in between because the CDC allowed the tail to go slightly further, and part of that was because it was based on federal taxable income and not AGI, and so there ended up being people with over $100,000 in income that qualified because of that. Their AGI was over $100,000, but their federal taxable income, you know, however that works. And then the working family closed people off at 250% of poverty. So we chose 300, basically 350% of poverty as somewhere in between. I would say there were one or two people on our committee that would have preferred to see that go further out.
Thank you, Anne. Having unfortunately spent 8 of my 10 years in this particular arena in revenue, I get it, I'm fine, and that's actually not my question. My question's the other end. If the bottom line is co-chairs, as typical, have decided that they're going to throw somebody under the bus and said, oh, you have $14 million. The proposal sheet, your spreadsheet, has 90 on it. It's not even all of what we have here. That's really the question I was having, is how many of both Democrat and Republican colleagues, you know, realize that this is really a better avenue than many other options we have. And then the second thing is that discussion of the tail, because, I mean, it's the tail. We obviously, at the front end, is where we want to be helping the most. And so if the tail has to be shortened, what's the mechanism of shortening the tail? Because, as you know, to get to 14 to 90, and there's three more pages here.
Yeah. So, sorry, if you go back to my Excel sheet, which is my overall, the 90 is based on a biennium. The 14 is the rest of this biennium. So it would really be 28. So just to make sure we're comparing apples to apples. The 14 million, we were told to try to get it down to, you were told to try to get it down to 14 million, which is the expiring tax credit, so it's just the last year of the biennium, and I was trying to show what this would cost over a biennium, so just keep that in mind. This would be a $45 million in recommended tax credits for the rest of this biennium. But that doesn't answer your whole question. I just wanted to make sure.
I'll ask you offline about your question, but I do have a follow-up to Chris to make sure everybody's on the same sheet of music. The spreadsheet that we have before us, the actual value of the sunset that we have to deal with at the Revenue Committee is not the 90,600,000. It's actually 45,300,000, correct?
Conceptually. The issue here is a one-year versus a two-year biennium. The $64 million and the $14 million, those refer to the 15-17 biennium, but it's just 1 year of tax credits because the tax credits are good through the first half of the biennium. So that discussion, and at the end of the day, when there's the official revenue impact statement on whatever policies the committee chooses, it will be roughly that 1 year policy number. So it would be half. The approach that Chair Kenny Geyer was referring to was wanting to look at a kind of a longer term, the full biennial concept. And so that's why the $90 million.
I'm follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay, Chris, I'm sold on that.
Oh, okay.
Let's get beyond that.
Okay.
What's it going to cost us to do this program? $45 million, right?
Is it the 34?
So 45 would be for all of the tax credits that we're suggesting?
Right. For the House side, yes.
Okay. Got it. Thanks.
And so one of the things that we tried to do just on the big kind of overall sheet without getting into the weeds is we tried to line up what it would cost for all of them. So that's $90 million over a biennium. So we increased these two child care tax credits, child independent care, and remember that some of that child independent care is for the 18 and over. But we also closed off a really major one, which was the long-term care insurance premium that was costing $20 million per biennium. That's a huge tie-off. And so we thought it's justifiable to put $3.8 million more, because part of the idea of that was to help people if they needed long-term care insurance, to help seniors go into long-term care insurance. In fact, it's helping almost entirely. The majority of it is going to people with over $100,000 in income. And it's not a product that's used a lot or thought highly of, and no one, even AARP and others, did not come testify. Not even insurance companies came. We thought they would. No one came, and we repeatedly said, we're planning on tying this off, sunsetting it, $20 million. Got no pushback whatsoever. And so we thought it was justifiable to put $3.8 million, both to really help lower-income families, but also to help dependent care for incapacitated spouses, disabled youth that pass the age of 18, grandparents in the house, and give them an option. You know, my preference would have been to put even more into that, to tell you the truth. But we wanted to start slowly because we don't want the cost to, you know, we're doing an estimate based on who's been using it in the past. But if this credit is actually more desirable and actually helps people stay at home more people may be claiming it. So we were making small
Smith
steps.
Warner, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They forgot to put the note that says share microphone down at this end. two things. I had wanted also to ask about the tail end at the right and whether that conveys that is the point beyond which you cannot claim this credit, which according to these is about $80,000.
Yes, so okay. It depends on whether you have, you know, one dependent, two dependents, three dependents, because your federal poverty line is going to change.
Okay.
But if you have several dependents, it's around $80,000. It would be even less, $65,000 maybe, or $70,000, okay. If you only have one dependent. And there are different tables in OLIS that show, you know, a family of two, a family of three, a family of four. A family of two is actually the meaning one taxpayer, one dependent, is actually the most common, which was surprising to me. We did a lot of work on one parent, two children, thinking that was the average. And then last week, we had a report to the Human Services sub that talked about the one parent, one child being 43%. And so we will notice if you go to that graph, specifically the visual graph, on the one parent, one child, it actually dips by 1%, which I think needs to be corrected. I would, you know, it's still a work in progress, and this we're presenting to you what our committee presented. But having learned that last week, and how many families are actually in that category, I think that should be bumped up a little bit. See how it dips down there a little bit.
Follow up.
Thank you. And the other thing I had wanted to call out that I admit to knowing this from participating in the carpool is.
See, we work all day, even when we go back and forth.
I was interested in the not only the refundability to push this back, you know, down the income scale to where people who need it more, but also combining this, that you had talked a lot about how the working families one was much more complicated to implement and administer. And part of combining this was to make it that as one, it will now be much easier to align and to utilize. Is that, am I remembering that
well,
right?
Well, I think it's clearly more easier for us to align and to make corrections. Like when you look at the, if you go back up to that graph, when you look at the fact that it's on the federal, it's 0000, then 1, then 6, then 13, you know, to be able to make those kind of corrections with one other tax, as opposed to have two different tax rates in the working family and the CDC, to know what we're doing, to be able to report it, to have the ease of tax payers filing it, the tax accountants, all of that is true. In terms of the Department of Revenue and can they save any expenses, they can rely on the IRS for families that are keeping their expenses under $3,000 and $6,000 because the eligibility of families is the same. But because we've increased the caps, if we go over those caps, then the IRS is not going to be monitoring that. We would still have to do it. The DOR has also said that they tend to want to monitor the parts that are refundable more than the parts that are just the tax credit. And I've wondered about that, and I've asked about that, because my sense is if somebody is claiming something either intentionally or not or by mistake that is allowing them more of a tax credit or refunded tax than they deserve, why is it? It's the same loss to the state, whether it's a tax credit for someone, you know, at a $60,000 as it is at a lower income. So why go after the people that are at the refundable level? And the response has been, well, it's because those dollars are harder to get back. They get spent, whereas you can tell someone they have a tax liability to hire. You know, that is a decision of DOR, not my decision, I would say. But that is why we may not see as much savings in the DOR as I originally hoped. I do hope that because some of these people are going to have expenses under $3,000 or $6,000, and many of them are not refundable, that piece will be taken care of by IRS. But I don't think we'll know what the expenses, what it'll be until we roll this out.
Senator, Representative Barnhart, you had a question?
Yes, I have two, if I may. The first one, I think, is simply a question of how the data is presented. I wonder if we could have a data presented as a dollar amount in addition to the percentage amounts we have here. If we could have a different chart that showed the dollar amounts at these different income categories, because I think the chart will look considerably different than this one, I'm guessing. The other thing that I'd like to raise is the timing issue. If I understand correctly, we're under the current law through the 16 tax year or the 15 tax year?
This is the last year, the end of this year. Through
15 is the last year. What if we made these changes effective January 1, 2015 instead of January 1, 2016? People won't be filing their tax returns until next year, what would the effect of it be on this coming biennium if we were to do that? And I don't expect an answer right now, but it'd be nice to have that so we could think about what we might do to make these adjustments early.
Okay.
The only thing that I would say for you to consider in that is that the working family, you have no other vehicle for that. It sunsetted because the Senate workforce didn't forward that, and we sunsetted it, both of us sunsetted it in our committees. And so for that to be amended to stop would need some kind of vehicle, I would guess.
Well, to be clear, no? if I could, Mr. Chair, to be clear, what I'm thinking about is putting into effect the changes that you're proposing, what your committee proposed, a year early. And that would mean sunsetting that working family child credit.
Can you do that through this vehicle? That's
the question. Our plan, if I could, Mr. Chair, is simply as we get to the point of actually understanding all of these credits that we want to propose to the legislature, that we would put all of them in one bill. And so we don't need a vehicle, separate vehicle, for any of this. Mm-hmm. The question is really what would be the effect of both on the situation of the bill, the issue that Senator Boqvist keeps raising, and the effect on the families that we're affecting, if we were to make it effective for the tax year 15, for which they file the tax returns in 16, instead of making it for 16, for which they file the tax returns in 17. If we made all the changes now that she's proposing, rather than next year. And that may be something you have to do a little arithmetic on, but that would be useful to have.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, the biennial, and this gets back to the way Rep. Kenny Geyer was describing it, that $3.8 million impact is a biennial impact. So the change for the work for these two child care tax credits for the 1 year impact is about $1.9 million. So if it were just changed in 2016, that's what you would see in the end. If you wanted to move it up to...
I'm looking at the whole list here, not just those two.
There's some confusion. The committee, and there has been some confusion in some of the other policy committees. All of these tax credits sunset at the end of this year. The legislature does not need to act to have those go away. And so the revenue impact right now would just be whatever policy changes take effect in 2016.
Can't do it.
And if you wanted to move something up, you can. It would depend on the bill that you have. So you could make, so for these two tax credits, it's that marginal impact. And for all of them, it's not like a $90 million impact to move it up to 2015, because right now, that's the easiest way to describe it. In 2015, the CDC and the existing CDC and the working family are going to cost around $28 million, $29 million for 2015. That's the projection. When people file their returns in 2016, that'll be the amount of the tax credit they claim. If instead the legislature, if you were to implement this new tax credit in lieu of those, in place of those, the cost goes up from $29 million to $31 million.
It's an increase of 12.
From 29 to 31.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
If you wanted to make that additional change and implement this earlier, but it does, and it would probably be best if I put that down in paper, so we could walk through that if you wanted me to, because it does get a little more abstract if you're starting to adjust effective dates.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Thank you. Excellent point.
I mean, as Chris said, it's about $2 million per quarter if you took the whole package, because you're buying backwards. And remember, you have to do in the rebalance. You'd have to have money out of the rebalance for the last 6 months of this session, and then the first 6 months into the next budget year. So it's not overly expensive.
I want to ask you about the refundability issue that you brought up, knowing that we theoretically have only $14 million to spend on renewing all of these tax credits. What savings is there by not making these refundability? It wasn't too long ago, for example, if the earned income tax credit was nobody wants to go there, but if we did, what's the trade-off there?
Well, some of that $3.8 million in cost is because of refundability, and some of it is on the other end, increasing credit amounts for a number of different areas, and also increasing for disabled dependents 18 and over. That's actually a smaller piece of the increase. But I would say it's a very strong policy recommendation from our committee, the refundability part. Again, you know, if we're really not helping people with child care costs if we're waiting until they get to the point where they have enough income to have a tax liability. The other conversation that this started in our committee was, how do we actually help people? Because if those lower income people, part of it's refundability, but part of it is they have to wait for a year to get any relief, and yet they're having to pay child care costs. And so there's another bill, House Bill 3541, going to the Revenue Committee that Representative Hayden, is he still in the audience? Took the lead on, which is a way to try to get a certain percentage of that credit back on a monthly basis. Okay. And I'm a co-chief sponsor of that. There's a number of people. Representative Reed is also on that bill. A number of people are really interested in that idea. I know it's been attempted in the past, and it's hard, but he worked very hard with Department of Revenue to try to come up with.
I was just trying to raise the awareness that there's a finite amount to spend here. Representative Benz, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. And thanks for all this work. That's really amazing. I was just glancing at the future of the federal EITC and the CTC and the expansions phase out in 17. So I was just wondering how linked, as you went through and modified the various amounts, how dependent the numbers you've come up with are on a continuation of the federal programs.
Not at all. I was actually not aware of that, Representative Pence, that the CDC is phasing out in 2017.
The expansion, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I think that's.
I was just reading from here. The recent expansions of the EITC and the Child Care Tax Credit will phase out in 2017. This is federal. And then, of course, there's lots of discussion about modifying them more to not just the expansions,
right,
but the programs themselves. So my question is.
Okay, thank you.
You have to deal with what we've got, of course.
Right.
And
right.
You have.
Right.
I'm just curious how big a part the federal program plays in the adjustments that you have made, because as you've gone through and tried to tailor it for need.
We did. Do you want to answer that? Oh, well, I'll take a quick stab at it, and then I'd love your support. We actually admittedly did not look forward to that. Thank you. This is great that it's halfway through the process, and you know there's always new things to consider. We looked at what the current situation is, but we did, thank you for bringing up the EITC, because part of what the research showed, the Duncan paper that's in OLIS connected to this bill, was that it's that the number one thing that you can do to help low-income families with young children in terms of a return on investment is not the two things. One is actually quality programs, early childhood programs, but the second thing is actually financial support. And their recommendation is to double the amount of EITC for families with young children. And so there's a separate bill that will go to the Revenue Committee that is to increase the EITC for children, for families with children under one. And the idea behind that is that if our policy is to support families who are looking to be gainfully employed, then we should also be looking at families that might want to stay home with a child at a very young age and recognize the loss of income that they have. And so that was a very widely supported bill in our committee as well. It doesn't go through you right now, but it would at least counteract some of the cutbacks in EITC, and again, connect it to what the research is saying.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just mentioned another quirk into the mechanism in another bill.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, May Day is just about here, and
yeah,
it's about vote time here, regardless of what any of us think.
Yeah.
Have you thought about, considering keeping that thought about, you know, expansion and the goal, and I mean, I think everybody, you look at this, you're trying to help that first group. Did you look at, or would you consider in your mind potentially taking the tail and pushing the tail back towards the head? Because that's really what you're talking about in the second bill. Take this mechanism here and push the tail back towards the head.
Phase it out sooner, you mean?
Right, and reinforce the front end of this thing so that you have more credits through a single mechanism.
Right.
And less credits the other end. I know the ideal.
Yep.
I got that represented. The ideal is keep the tail, add more to the front. But,
right.
But you understand what I'm
saying. We had a lot of debate in our committee about that, and you can see that the federal actually has no means testing at all in terms of the 20%. It continues to cover 20% of allowable expenses, which is capped at $3,000 and $6,000. You could be making $500,000, and it's not capped, which is the reason that I was in favor. When you look at how do you balance the different credits, I was okay with capping it a little earlier, but there was a lot of debate on our side, and there was at least one Republican and one Democrat that expressed a lot of concern about people who are at the 60 to 90,000 level and you know, the lack of support that they get. And so that's why the 300% federal poverty line was kind of a compromise there. It's more than the working family. It's less than the Oregon. But it only shaves the Oregon CDC by a very little. You know, we were doing 4%. We were doing the current goes up to 330% of poverty is that you still get a 4%. Mm-hmm. And the new one caps out at 300%. So we did cut it off a little bit more, and that caused some heartache on our committee.
What is 300% with two children?
With two children, 300% is $60,270, and with four children, obviously, it'd be more. With one child, it would be less.
Okay. We have no more questions.
I just one, if I could. All of this is posited on the idea that somebody in the household is working.
Right?
None of this happens if you're not working.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Which is why the EITC would be helpful for people who have a child and then aren't working or are working a very small amount. You have to have earned income to get the EITC, actually.
Same thing.
Right.
Right, and so making it refundable.
Both of them you have to have.
Making it refundable simply means then that we're going to strongly encourage people at the lowest end to get some work.
Right. So just again, to reinforce this, because I am really passionate about this issue, and the committee agreed that if you've got someone who is not making enough to have a tax liability, and you want them to go out and get a job and pay for childcare, and childcare is so expensive, particularly if they have more than one child, it doesn't pan out to work if you're not giving them any support. That the minute they have any kind of, they reach a high enough level, we give them support, but when they're below that, we don't. And it's so counterintuitive to what we're trying to do with TANF. And again, I think it's important that even at the lower ends before TANF, if you think about people on TANF who are making whatever it is, $600 a month, it's very, very little money, and you want them to go to back to work and you want them to get child care. And child care is so expensive. What, you know, we can put money into the TANF jobs program, and I'm a strong supporter of that, but what are we doing to complement the TANF program, the subsidy program, with really helping people get back to work and offset the incredible cost of child care?
That's a great note to end this presentation.
Can I just say something about the disability ones, though?
You want to move on to disability?
There are other tax credits here. And we did not go as into great detail, so... out of the four in the category of people with disabilities, again, I'm just looking at my big Excel sheet, there were two that we recommended continuing but capping, means testing it, and those were child with disability and then people with a severe disability. So those are personal exemptions on the tax form. We did not spend a lot of time with this. They are not refundable right now, and that would be something that I would love to consider. But again, in this financial climate, I was a little bit worried about that. And the research that came out of the excellent report on the expiring tax credits basically said that the best help that policy has shown is that we don't just give people money because to offset the fact that they might have a disability, but it's to really help people stay gainfully employed. And that's part of why we spent a lot of attention on that particular piece. But we also thought, you know, we talked about if you had someone like, now I'm blanking on who it is, Stevie Wonder, you know, does he need a personal exemption tax credit? At some point, it should be means tested. And so where would that be? And so we ended up choosing the amount of $100,000 to cap it at, for incomes over $100,000. In part, that's what we did in the grand bargain. But also, one of the testimony we had from Disability Rights is that, I think it was Disability Rights Oregon, was that in general, if you have someone with a disability in the household, it costs about $30,000 more. And because we're capping our CDC at somewhere around $60,000, $65,000, $70,000, that $100,000 seemed like a reasonable amount that to cap that. And that brings a little bit of a savings. The next two, which are the loss of limbs and the elderly and permanently disabled, are ones that very, very few people use. So Representative Hayden's amendment is on the loss of limbs. The committee sunsetted that bill, so you do not have it from our House committee. But there were three people on the House committee that had a lot of anguish about that and said, why should we, you know, this might help veterans. This, you know, we don't know what this was originally for. There was no original policy intent when that got put forward. It's the loss of at least two limbs. These people are also covered by the severe disability. And so in the work groups and then in the discussion that we had as a recommendation from the whole committee going forward is that, you know, why are you giving it turns out to be average $50 for, I think it's 500 people. It comes to about $25,000 a year, and it actually has gone down over the last couple of years. Why are you prioritizing someone? You're already giving us a severe disability. Why all of a sudden two limbs? You know, was this a legislator that just passed this on behalf of a constituent a long time ago? And whether it's someone in a car accident or whether it's a war veteran, what about brain injuries? What about loss of, you know, an eye? What about a severe burn? And so it's hard for me to get up and talk about this and recommend, and it was, I think, kind of ironic that it's actually the Democrat saying, why are we, you know, extending this kind of assistance? And the Republican saying, no, we should be giving that kind of. So I think it was kind of an interesting debate in our committee, and I want to be very fair to the three people who spoke up and were concerned about tying this off. But I did have a lot of very open about it with people with disabilities about why are we picking one particular kind of disability and giving additional help on top of the severe disability. So that the overall majority went with the recommendation not to bring that forward. You do still have a vehicle on the Senate side, and Representative Hayden's is not only to extend it, but actually to beef that one up.
Committee, I think Representative Kenny Geyer did about 80% of the work for us in the last 4 months.
Now we know what you've been doing.
And the last two are just the long-term care. These fall under health, the long-term care insurance, which I talked about already, and the cost in lieu of nursing home care, which gives a very, very small amount. We could have really worked on that and tried to beef that up, but it has been such a small amount, not refundable, hardly covered. It really is not going to serve as an incentive at all to help keep people at home instead of going to institutional care. And so putting our effort more in the child independent care and looking at potentially beefing that up over time as a way to really help offset costs so that people can go to work and still be able to keep someone in their home is the direction that we would like to pursue.
Yes, Representative Woodson.
I just want to say, even though I agree with what's happening on the long-term care insurance premiums, they went up between 20% and 25% just this last quarter, and there are some people that fall into that who are on very, very limited incomes mm-hmm. in my district who pointed out to me that the premiums increased from the insurance companies across the board. I talked to the insurance commissioner, and she said that's just what's happening. So it will profoundly affect a certain number of people, certainly probably yeah. not enough to continue it, but I just want to say that is out there for yeah. a certain number of people on really limited incomes. So.
Thank you, Representative Whitsett. And I know John Mullen is going to be testifying, and he may address that. You know, we don't know how much this served as either just cost offsetting versus an incentive. Originally, it was set up as an incentive to reduce costs to Medicare and Medicaid in the future. Because so many low-income people are not claiming it, it has not shown any. Again, the research that came out of your report has not shown any savings in that regard. So if the idea was to try to save the state money in the long run, it doesn't seem to be doing that. But, you know, one of the things about sunsetting it is that we will find out if there's a big drop. But the other thing that I've heard is that there are a lot better products out there that actually really help people. And one of the things that I'm committed to is working with the seniors, to say, are there better products that we could be offering? We just didn't, in this compressed session, have the time to do that, but I think that's a really fair question. And we should be incentivizing people to actually buy really good products.
Well, if I may, it helps them stay in their homes.
Right.
For those people who, some of them have been paying for 20 or 30 years premiums into this long-term care, and now they've just started raising
right.
premiums, and so some of them can't afford it now.
Right.
Literally, it's in the hundreds of dollars, on their year by annual, I guess,
right.
Premiums. So, you know, it will be interesting to see if you get a drop-off, and then if they have to go to the rest home or senior care centers, and
right.
the state pays for them or whatever. So.
Right.
Thank you. All right, Representative, thank you. And
thank
I'm
you.
Sure you'll be hearing from committee members as we try to digest some of what you're
Yeah, and I would just like to offer for that final 20% that, you know, we didn't do. I'm happy to continue working with anyone on your sure. committee on it. Sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We do have some people who have signed up to testify on these bills, and I want to get to them, and I just would ask you, without setting up clocks and timers and timekeepers, that you just keep your comments short to a couple of minutes and don't feel the need to read your testimony into the record. So let's start with Chuck Shekatoff, John Mullen, and Merrill A. Haas.
Chuck Shekatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I want to begin by saying I think Representative Kenny Geyer did just an amazing job in her committee. I've seen a number of the substantive committees struggle with the tax credit bills they were sent that they're not used to getting. And I think a lot of committees did very good work. Some committees quickly just pushed them back to you guys. And I think the work that their committee did was just pretty amazing. We had a number of work group meetings and great staffing by Chris and DOR. And I want to address just a couple of the issues. I think the issue of the keeping it refundable is really key. Well, that was key when it was first created. It actually, when it first passed the Senate 30-0, it was refundable in that first year, first few years. They took that away that session, but that was what advocates got put back in, because if it's not refundable, the people who need it the most don't get the full credit. And the alternative is to do carry forwards, and low income people don't usually use accountants who can keep track of their carry forwards accurately. And so the having it refundable is very key. Having a cap, I think, is important. I think the 300% of poverty, you know, you can play with those numbers. I thought that was a reasonable choice. It is a little outrageous at the federal level that there isn't a cap on the federal one that for that. I share some of the concerns that Representative Kenny Geyer and others about the DOR costs. I've been very concerned over the years seeing tax court cases over working family and child and dependent care credit cases. So they don't initiate a review. They don't do audits. They do these reviews that the agency can tell you about. And they don't initiate if the person just has a child and dependent care credit. But if they have the working family credit, they do initiate them, and then they go after your claim for both of them. Okay, and I see cases with very little money at stake going to the tax court. A few weeks ago, I wrote the tax court and said, "Well, how much do these cases cost?" And they said, "We can't tell you that," which I find odd. So I made note of that for the Secretary of State and Audits Division and the budget people here. And I asked the Department of Revenue, "What's your cost benefit analysis on how, you say it's costing $500,000 to go after all these working family child care credit cases? Where's the cost? Where's your cost? How many do you win on? Do you lose on? How much do you negotiate?" And they don't have it. And so that's very frustrating to me. You know, a lot of, if you look at the cases that actually where the person showed up in tax court, a significant number of the people win all or some of their credit. There's a number of them where the people somehow get the wherewithal to file a tax court claim after they have a administrative process and don't follow through with it. So you can't really look at the win-loss ratio overall. But if you look at the ones that actually went to tax court, some of the people win. And I sort of wonder why they're doing this. So I share the concern, and the bill doesn't, because of the way it's structured, doesn't reduce the, probably isn't going to reduce the, my guess, the cost at the department level. As far as the question about that came up earlier about the being tied to the child independent care credit, I have the same concern. So I checked with my friends who are certified SMART in Washington, D.C. That's not a credit that's sunsetted. I think it's the improvements to the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, that $500 tax credit. Those are the ones that are up in the air now in D.C., not the child independent care credit. I think there are some winners and losers as an all tax policy. If you look at the top, that page two, the now infamous page two, with the graphs with the top, you'll see the red, I think it is, shows that there's some blue lines showing above it at certain points at the top of the curve. There's going to be some losers, but I think there's going to be some winners with younger kids and at the lower end, and so that probably all is appropriate. You're always going to have some of that. So just want to say we support that bill. I have concerns about some of the other bills, but I think you just wanted to hear about the child care credit bill. And I also just want to say I think Representative Barnhart's idea of perhaps moving it to January, changing the sunset, the bill would have to change the sunset date, but having it all start in for tax year 2015 is one that you should certainly look at. I think that was a great idea to look at.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, Oregon Law Center, here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. In the interest of time, there's a fair amount of context in my testimony, which is on OLIS. I would just point out that as a coalition, we have to accommodate the positions of many people with specific differences about tax credits. But I would say that our policies are firm about what we are interested to do, and further that we are really appreciative of the process of taking a close look at all of these particular tax credits that are up for sunset. For this, coming into this session, We had three tax credits that we were firmly in support of. The IDA, which was heard at your last meeting, individual development accounts, the child independent tax credit, and the working family child care tax credit. Knowing that those added up to some $36 million, which was already outside of the box of what the co-chairs had proposed for Ways and Means. But prior to the session, we also talked a fair amount about were there instances where tax credits could be combined, become more efficient, and be streamlined. This happened before session, and we particularly gave some focus to the tax credits that relate to people with disabilities. I will go through very quickly our position on all of the ones that are in front of you today, just to say that, but before I do that, I want to just mention briefly about House Bill 2116, because we did participate in the work group, and I really want to acknowledge the work that Representative Kenny Geyer did. Obviously, she did her homework. She did just really basically what us as advocates have always wanted to see happen, to have these deep dives on the policy considerations and what really happens to affect the budget and for the tax expenditures as a whole for what you have in front of you, because you always have the challenge with the sunsets of also looking at other new ideas that come your way about various tax expenditures. So really want to acknowledge her work and also the work of your staff, Chris Alanak. To get to the specifics, House Bill 2113 and Senate Bill 49, contributions to the Office of Child Care, our position is allow those tax credit to sunset. House Bill 2119 and Senate Bill 43, severe disabilities. We talked about here again about the idea of combining and refocusing with other tax credits as appropriate and have a clear policy on what the intent is and the effect tax credits have for those people with disabling conditions. The same applies to 2122 and Senate Bill 40. Senate Bill 38, expense in lieu of nursing homes, allowed a sunset. Senate Bill 39 that Representative Kenny Geyer said that I would mention, long-term care insurance, that's also allowed. We suggest that be allowed to sunset. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that. Senate Bill 41, elderly or permanently disabled, again, the same discussion about refocusing and combining as appropriate. 42, loss of limbs, allowed a sunset for very much the same reasons that Representative Kenny Geyer had put forward. And then finally about House Bill 212, which expands the contributions to the Office of Child Care. HISCO did not support that. Finally, I just end with the discussion you've been having this morning about the charge in front of you, the directions from the co-chairs, and making some very, very difficult decisions. When you peel it all back and you talk about individual things like the loss of limbs tax credit, for example, or the long-term care insurance tax credit, you can always think about people that would be affected adversely by changes. As you're all very much aware of, anything dealing with tax policy has winners and losers, and we just encourage you to make the best policy decisions possible. We're interested to continue having discussion with the committee as you go forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Emily.
Thank you. My name is Marilee Haas, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association for the Education of Young Children, and I'm representing our 850 members throughout the state of Oregon. And this is one of the few areas that probably John and I would disagree on, and that is the support for the contributions to the Office of Child Care. This fund, and you saw in red highlight in the presentation made by Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer, is one of the few tax credit that actually brings net income into the state, and that the contribution has to be higher than the credit that is awarded. And it has a tremendous benefit through this dedicated fund to child care providers in increasing quality around the state. I had an experience when the funds first became available for the education awards, which are in the amounts of $100, $250, or $500 to cash check payments made to individual providers based on their educational attainments. I was in La Grande, a rural community in Oregon. Two of the providers were very proud that they had finally achieved their associate degrees And as a result of that and getting to the step 9 on the Oregon Registry, they had recently received a check for $500. One gave the story that she was she put it in the bank, was wondering what to do with it. Her water heater broke. She didn't have the reserve funds other than this check that had come in. She couldn't continue to operate her childcare business for health and safety reasons without a working water heater. She spent that money in the local economy, replaced her water heater, continued her business. She said it was a blessing that she had had those dollars. Another provider was excited because she had long been planning improvements to her outdoor play space for the children. And she said with the $500 check that she had received, she was finally going to be able to do landscaping improvements, drip irrigation, some new sod so the children could actually play on grass in her backyard. These are impacts that happen in every community throughout, in every county and community in the state. And they're dedicated specifically because those providers have continued their education and achieved a certain education level. If we want to target dollars specifically towards quality, this is one way to do it. And even though it's a tax credit, it also does bring dollars into this dedicated fund in the state. So I would urge your support of that particular issue. We also are in support of the refundable tax credit for employment-related care, but there seems to be a lot of support and momentum towards that one. Thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn. Questions? Thank you. Eva Repito, James Barta, and Leslie Sutton. And we would thank you for, in advance, for your brief synopsis.
Co-chair asks members of the committee, my name is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon. We're working to make Oregon the very best place to be a kid. And in the interest of brevity, I just want to talk about my suggested takeaways over Representative Kenny Geyer's work. I was a participant in the work group. I was very impressed how diligent she was, along with Chris Alanak. And overall, I think this achieves the type of goals that we all support when we're out talking to members of the public, your constituents. Basically, we are, one, simplifying the tax code for the poorest Oregonians, you know, where there are two overlapping tax credits for people with children to figure out. Now there'll be one. And reduce the administrative costs without without having to do the audits at the similar intensity. We would see a reduced cost in those administrative costs and those investigations and people claiming credits. And finally, and most importantly, this is a tax credit that helps not only does it help the poor, but it helps encourage the poor to become working. And so I know there are a lot of demands on the funds that the legislature faces, that the revenue committees face, but there are few things that I think you could take home to describe to your constituents as one that does these three things. And so I urge your support for this, and I look forward to seeing your continued work on it.
Thank you, sir.
Co-Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is Eva Repito. I work for Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent licensed in-home child care providers in the state. AFSCME is supportive of House Bill 2116, the Working Families and Dependent Care Tax Credit. I think that's the full title now. I appreciate all the work that has been put into it. I think that in my testimony I say 290% of FPL, and I will correct that as Representative Kenny Geyer was talking about, it's up to 300%. So I apologize for my error. My written testimony covers pretty much everything. I think that I was tremendously appreciative of the thought that went into it, especially in protecting families with older children as well, and their their access to this program. I also want to echo the support that Mary Lee Haas has given for House Bill 2113, Senate Bill 212, the extension and expansion of the Office of Child Care Credit. Our child care providers are receiving direct payments for reaching milestones in their professional development and achievements on the quality rating and improvement system. One of the things that I hear from child care providers is that while the QRIS is not mandatory, they are eager to participate, but it's difficult to sustain the levels that are required by the program. So having these incentives and these the checks that go directly for their milestones is helpful in keeping them at those levels. I also wanted to say that the expansion is important because as we have more providers participating in the program, we're going to have more of a demand for these incentives. And as they achieve higher levels of education and higher levels on the QRIS, we should look at ways to help them maintain those levels. So I urge your support of the Office of Child Care donation tax credit as well as House Bill 2116. Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Sutton, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. We're a coalition of about 30 organizations working to improve the lives of Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families. We were also involved in the stakeholder group you've heard a lot about today, and we're very impressed with the process. We believe that everybody benefits when a person with a disability has the supports that they need to be successful in life, and the coalition does support the disability-related tax credits that are before you today. The policy behind these tax credits is really about making a recognition that living with a disability costs more than living without a disability. And we know that this is true. In my written testimony, I've cited a study that shows that for parents of children with disabilities, you know, per year, the cost could range from anywhere from $10,000 to $65,000 a year. That is a large part of anybody's income. And we recognize there are also indirect costs to raising a child with a disability. For instance, you hear a lot of families say, I couldn't access childcare because I couldn't find a place that was appropriate for my child. So that means that we're now a single-income family. So that is an indirect cost that we do know families are living with here in Oregon. For adults with disabilities, we know that statistics show that their level of employment is much lower than people without disabilities. Yet in Oregon, we're seeing people with intellectual and developmental disabilities saying, I want to work. We're seeing 3 out of 4 parents saying, my kid with a disability is going to work when they're an adult. And we see that these tax credits are a way of saying, okay, we can help you by offsetting some of these disability-related needs. We realize this is a small offset in the grand scheme of how much this could really be costing families, but we do think it's an important policy recognition that Oregon needs to make. One note on the House bill versus the Senate bill that are before you, the House bill 2119 and 2122 make this a means-tested tax credit as opposed to Senate Bill 40 and 43. We've had a lot of conversation in the coalition about that, and in the end agreed that although we realize some families would be losing out and the policy is really about recognizing the cost of disability, we would be okay with a means-tested. We don't love it, but recognizing the revenue impacts and things like that, we are willing to move forward with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for your help on this. Marcia Kelly, I have you signed up. Are you still? Okay. Final witness. Yeah, the House has caucus. Both caucus. Thank you for being brief, Marcia.
I will. Marcia Kelly, Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. First and foremost, we believe the work that Representative Kenny Geyer and her work group did on those child credits are quite good and endorse the sunset on the long-term care insurance and the in-home elderly care as well. For women to be able to afford long-term term care insurance, it would take a really high percentage of their wages in order to do that, and we don't believe that offsetting long-term care insurance for higher-income individuals with a tax credit gives as much bang for the buck as putting those dollars into the services we provide for elderly senior women.
Okay. Thank you very much. No questions. Thank you all for participating in this committee. We're going to adjourn here. I should announce next Thursday we will not meet because we have the May revenue forecast.
And we,
2 weeks. Next Thursday we will meet. Okay, so we have a lot to digest here, and thank you for your indulgence. We will adjourn.
Thanks.
We will adjourn.
Thanks.